This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.
And welcome to The Blank Podcast, the podcast where we talk to well-known guests about their lives, their careers, and those difficult moments along the way. I'm Giles Pay-Phillips, and with me, as ever, is Jim Daly.
Hello! How you doing?
All right, that's an interesting hello.
I just thought I'd change it up today. Yeah, I felt a bit musical. We got a musical theatre guest, so I felt a bit musical. So, that was me trying to sing.
Yeah, I was thinking we could do the whole thing as in musical theatre, perhaps. The whole introduction.
Could do. The first songs are really important in musical theatre because it sets that they're the songs that have like all the information in there. They really like a lot of exposition.
Okay. Here's a quick fire round. Top five all time opening numbers. Go.
Oh, I don't know enough about musical theatre for that.
Top one then.
Top five opening numbers to musical theatre productions. Hello, Book of Mormon's quite a good opener.
Yeah, I'm gonna say we could do it together. Let's just do our like a joint top five. I'm gonna say always on my mind. No, that's not the right word. Heaven's on their mind from Jesus Christ Superstar.
Oh man, that's a classic.
Judas sings that one. It's really got a really cool like guitar lick in it.
Well, it's all Jesus Christ Superstar is all like basically the Bible set to funk, isn't it? Yeah,
70s rock. Yeah,
yeah. What's the opening? Is Hamilton the opening number? Alexander Hamilton. Oh, no, I got that wrong. Whatever is the opening to? I feel like it is. It's like introduces him and the story and stuff.
Do you know, I'm going to say The Greatest Showman has got a good opening number as well.
I guess that does count, doesn't it? Because that is, I was thinking stage, but I guess that counts, doesn't it?
What about Sound of Music? The Hills Are Alive.
There you go. So we're opening up. Yeah, I guess that counts. Yeah, I mean, it definitely counts.
West Side Story, that's got a great opening number. The Jets and the Sharks.
Yeah, it does. Have you seen the latest remake?
I haven't. I've kind of put off because I love the 1960s one. I've heard it's good.
My wife loves, I mean, it's literally her favourite film, the original, but liked the remake. Like, it wasn't as good as the original.
It's long, the new one. It's like 3 hours, I think.
Oh, yeah, it might be.
I think that.
I enjoyed it. It was good. But Miranda, so if you love it, I feel like you might be okay because Miranda thought it was okay.
Yeah, I'll definitely check it. Spielberg, you can't go wrong with Steven Spielberg. Generally, he's
you can't pretty, really can you? Pretty... Alexander Hamilton is the opening song to Act One, so we're gonna include that.
Well, maybe some of our listeners could tweet us some of their favourite opening numbers to musicals.
Yeah, that'd be lovely. I mean, just any
such enthusiasm. Yeah, that'd be all right.
Any tweets would be good. So I'm really tired. I apologise if my energy levels were low. We're recording this the day after we did the interview with our guest, and I'm just really tired.
Low energy, yeah.
I'm low energy, sorry. This is a problem with evening records. Yes. When we do it normally on a Friday morning, we're a bit more upbeat, but I'm tired and cold. Anyway, that is not the energy to introduce this week's guest.
It isn't.
She is a legend of stage and screen, and this was a lovely, lovely interview.
It really was. It's the awesome Bonnie Langford.
It is. I thought you were going to say, for some reason, I thought the word you're going to say was indomitable. Indomitable.
Indomitable, yeah. I don't actually know what that means.
Indomitable. impossible to subdue or defeat.
Oh, that's wow.
Actually good. That's actually, because actually we talk about sort of like resilience on this episode. So that's, I would say she's the indomitable Bonnie Langford. And that, man, that's a good name for a podcast, actually.
Indomitable. Yeah.
If you're talking about resilience and many of the subjects we cover.
Yeah, I think that's great name.
It's a good name for an Edinburgh show, actually.
Mm.
Anyway, Bonnie Langford, what a... Sorry to make it about me as ever. So I was speaking of, before we get into it, my solo show. I'm doing final ever outing of my Edinburgh show, Jim Daly Football and Fatherhood. Not as good title as Indomitable. Never mind, that's a future show.
Yeah.
At Angel Comedy on Thursday the 7th of February. So about 3 weeks away at 6:30 p.m. At the Bill Murray, which is a lovely venue. Tickets are £8 from angelcomedy.co.uk. And it's a 4-star show. So please do come along. Last time I'm doing it, it's being filmed. So it'd be great to have an audience. And it's a fun show. I'm proud to present it for the final time. So if you are in London around then, please do come along.
I've got an advert as well.
Oh, yeah. This is the time.
Yeah, let's just get all the adverts out before we actually talk about the guest. I've got a new book that you can support and buy. It's called Gigantium. It's a sci-fi drama written in verse. And if you've already bought my other books, 150 Days and A Little Piece of Mind, it's very much in the same kind of vein as those two. And you can get it from Unbound. So if you go to Unbound / Giles Paley Phillips, or I think it might be, no, sorry, let's start that again. It's Unbound / Gigantium. That's Gigantium. And then you can find it on there. You can get your pre-order your copy, and it really helps because it's with Unbound you have to you get people to support the project. And then it becomes a real thing,
and so, then become part of the whole journey of the publication. We'll put links below the show notes to both of those things,
yes,
so that people can just click. But yeah, please do support either or both. It'd be lovely. We do appreciate it very much. Bonnie Langford.
Yeah.
I mean, an icon, really.
Yeah, and actually, she's been in some iconic things. I was just thinking when we were interviewing her, like obviously Bugsy Malone was a huge movie, 1976, Alan Parker was the director, fantastic. Launched the career of Jodie Foster, among others.
Yeah.
And then, of course, she was in Doctor Who, which is British institution, and then EastEnders, which is also another British institution. So these sort of really big things I guess will stay with you if you continue your career. Those kind of big productions that you're involved with, they sort of stay with you, don't they?
And it stays clearly from what she says, certainly about EastEnders. It stays with the viewers as well. Like some of the stories she says about meeting fans of EastEnders is really, really nice, the way it sort of impacts their lives. And even like we talk a lot about childhood in this episode. I say one of the longest of any of our episodes, and talking about growing up. And, you know, Opportunity Knocks is where she got her break, I guess, at six.
Six years old. Yeah.
I mean, that's also an iconic show.
For younger listeners to the podcast who might not know what Opportunity Knocks is or was, it's basically, I guess, like Britain's Got Talent is now. It's that sort of similar vein, isn't it?
Yeah, in 1970. So it's like the Opportunity Knocks in 1970. And then one of her early roles was in Gypsy, which is a stunning theatre show alongside Angela Lansbury.
Yeah.
So talking about sort of icons and talks a lot about her, which is really nice, and mentors and stuff. So, I mean, Bonnie's just like been there and done it. And she's got some fantastic stories, a lovely outlook on life. And it's just a really lovely, bubbly, friendly character as well to talk to. So it was a great episode.
Yeah, really lovely to talk to Bonnie. And great to spend some time with her. And like you say, lots of great animal analogies in this podcast.
We'll leave it at that. We won't tease it anymore. Yeah. But there are T-shirt potential.
Yes, lots of merchandise. Can be created via this episode. So thank you, Bonnie, for giving us all those little
snippets. We should. Well, we won't, because we always forget to do it.
Yeah.
So we just, it will never go. It will never happen. Unless any of our listeners want to make those T-shirts.
Yeah.
Anyway, shall we get into it?
I think we should.
This is the fantastic Bonnie Langford on The Blank Podcast.
Well, Bonnie, it's fantastic to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
Lovely to see you. We normally start these things at the beginning, and obviously you got into the public's attention very early in your life, at six, you know, which is amazing, but I guess also kind of a bit beguiling and a bit strange. I mean, at 6 years old, are you kind of aware of that time? Because obviously we form certain memories around that time, but yeah. I mean, does that era of your life, is it still quite prevalent in your head?
Oh, I'm so pleased I started then, because I do remember it. I remember it vividly. And what was great for me was that, I mean, my life was completely the same. Nothing changed. I just went somewhere. It's like going to the fun fair for the day, really. And nothing changed when I came home, which is exactly the right thing. I mean, so my first appearance was at 6 years old on the television in Opportunity Knocks, TV talent show that was huge. It was the only one that was on the telly.
Yeah.
And so I found it all very interesting and extraordinary. And they filmed literally 10 minutes away from my home. So it was, as I say, it was like going for sort of a day trip to a new place, which was a television studio. And I found it absolutely fascinating. I found the people fascinating, because I was a very, very quiet child. I just, when I was, you know, doing my job as such, I went into that mode, and that was my security. And I always think that it was because when I first went on stage, I was 3 months old. Not that I remember that at all. Wow. I really don't.
Wow.
But my mother had a dancing school. My two sisters attended it. And when I was 3 months old, she carried me on at the end of the kind of the yearly annual show, because she'd had to delay when that show went on. And so she carried me on instead of a bouquet at the end. And apparently I just sort of looked at the light and adored it and all that sort of stuff. But from then on as well, you see, if I ever went on the stage, my two sisters were holding my hands. So I think it was just a very happy place to be. And everyone seemed very jolly. So when I went off and did Opportunity Knocks, I was just quiet. I didn't have my sisters with me, but my father came with me, and then my mother joined for the recording later on that day because she was teaching. So it was never a big deal. In fact, in some respects, I think they played it down so much that there were times when I didn't get the full enjoyment out of things, because they were so busy being, no, it's nothing, you know, it's just a lovely experience, and that was fun. So in many respects, it kept me very level-headed. But at the same time, possibly there were things I maybe could have got more out of and enjoyed more. It was very, very played down.
I think that's the way to go, though, as parents, isn't it, with kids, to keep everything feeling normal. And actually, it's funny you say about sort of holding your sister's hands on stage, because the word that came to me was safe. Like that, I guess that made being on stage quite a safe place for a young person. Because before you form memories, apparently, I've got two young children, and apparently before you form memories, you form feelings. Mm. And so you might not remember stuff, but you remember, oh, I felt safe at home, or I felt loved and stuff. So I guess maybe you were getting those feelings at the same time.
Absolutely. I think you've hit the nail on the head there. I think I did feel very loved and very safe. I was a much younger, well, 10 years younger than my eldest sister and 8 years younger than my second sister. And I was just this, I think I was this little toy, actually, that they just, I was a real life dolly. And there was quite a lot of sort of madness and fun, but my home was filled with love. And I think going on stage for me was a very safe space. I don't remember feeling worried at all. I don't know that I felt any expectations either. Mm. I just did what I was meant to do. And that made life very easy, didn't it? You know, it was a case of, well, what's the problem here? And also, because I performed in amongst my mother's dancing school, she was running it, and the people around me were all my friends. It was a place where I used to go when I was a little baby. I was just put in a chair when she was teaching, and I would sit there and she'd teach, and occasionally I'd get up and join in. And it just was a place filled with love and security.
But it isn't that idea of like, this is just what I do. I'm on stage and I'm just doing whatever. It's funny how, without jumping forward too much, like it's funny how we sort of lose that as adults when we become sort of more insecure, more like self-aware. But in a way, that kind of should be the way that all performers treat things now anyway. I'm just doing what I do, but it's not.
Yeah. No, I know. Well, we become aware, don't we? You know, I mean, that's the whole point. When we're kids, we have no problem with playing make-believe and just, you know, and completely and utterly committed. I mean, isn't it fascinating when you watch kids? And I love that programme that I haven't seen for a while now, but the one, is it where they put the elderly people with the 4-year-olds?
Yeah.
And isn't it just blissful to watch? Yeah. That magic happening, because you know there is this element, you know, it awakens the child in the older person, and the child kind of bonds with this quiet, calm person who's maybe slightly taking things a little bit easier, and they bring such magic out in each other. You know, the kid just turns around and says, "Well, come on, walk with me, run with me," and doesn't really understand that this person probably isn't as mobile as they'd like to be. But it gives, you know, because the child is so innocent and has that wonder about the world, there's such a wonderful connection. And it gets the cantankerous out of the older person. Because
absolutely.
They're being made to do something in such an innocent and kind fashion. So I love that programme. And I think that's, I think when do we become aware? I find it so sad, isn't it, when kids... And we're making kids lose their childhood so much earlier. And I think that's sad. I mean, it's been going on for years, but you sort of think, oh, you know, you've got to grow up quite quickly. No, don't.
Yeah.
Don't. I mean, you've grown up for a long, long time, and the responsibility with all that and the, you know, and sometimes, you know, kids now, they want things fixed so quickly. Oh, okay, something's wrong with my life. I need to change this. No. Just work your way through things. You know, just... take that time. Why does everything have to be such a rush these days?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I was wondering, actually, just going on from what Jim was saying there, as creatives, obviously we're all creatives here, whether we are sort of striving to get back some of that innocent joy that we got from when we maybe first did that certain things. Maybe Jim, like for you, like first time you got on stage doing a stand-up routine or something. Yeah. For me, like just, you know, playing the guitar or whatever it might be. And I guess for you as well, Bonnie, like performing, getting back to being that six-year-old performing on a stage. Maybe there's something in that keeps us doing it, maybe. Yeah.
Oh, I think so. I think you know, in creative industries, we're more in touch with our inner child than anybody, because we're using that to understand our emotions, and so we need to sort of stay with it. But the problem is when it becomes your job, it's very hard to then keep that momentum and to connect still with that, with the pressure of realizing that we're being judged, that somebody might say something about us. And what I thank my parents for so much is that they did really protect me from stuff that people would say. First of all, I mean, when I was first on telly in the 70s, so it was a much simpler world. And we only had 3 channels of telly. I mean, you know, it was just that kind of thing. There wasn't that access so much to such immediate judgment.
Yeah.
And if there was, my parents kept me from it. And, you know, I did have stuff said about me, you know, but I, you know, I was kept away from it quite a lot. Because people will always, even if they're saying something to be funny, it can have an effect on you. It can have an impact. So to protect that wonderful innocence, I think is so important. But also equally what I had as a child, I had, as you say, you know what you're expected to do. You go out there, you do it. And in some respects, that's why I went to stage school. because I wasn't different, because everyone had that common intention, common ambition, that they wanted to be creative in whatever way. And it was very supportive. And also, it wasn't different. It was a case of, you know, you weren't the odd one out. Everyone was doing the same thing, maybe in a different guise. And also, they were very keen to sort of support one another. Oh, you know, that. Well, there was my first school that I went to were very into training, which was important. And it was sort of, it was how you channel that, how you keep that technique so that you can do your job when you're not feeling up to it or when you don't feel like it. You know, you can switch it on. There are certain ways and techniques to get into the into that seam, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And to try and connect with that, still that that joy and that love, but also, you know, have the vulnerability, do that. But also, you could be professional and know that when you were expected to do something, you didn't say, "Oh, I don't feel like it today." You have to find the way to feel like it today, and that, you know, the expectations. From example, you know, from a television studio, you can't suddenly turn around and go, "No, I'll do it tomorrow," because you've got an entire crew standing there. It's costing a fortune. You know, yeah, come on, come up with the goods and then everything will be fine. So there was that. But also my first school, they were very into training and did not like me performing at all. And that was my first encounter, really, with feeling I was maybe doing something, well, A, that was different, but that wasn't being necessarily shared graciously. Mm. And fortunately,
Was wrong somehow.
Well, it was I was told not to show off. Yeah. And it felt so strange to me because I was not a show off kid.
Yeah.
As I say, I was almost, you know, well, don't be noisy, don't show off, stay quiet, keep your light hidden until it's required.
Yeah.
Which I understood, but don't show off. Well, I was like, well, I'm not showing off, I'm sharing.
Yeah.
I went to America as a young kid. I was 9 years old. I had been in a show called Gypsy at the Piccadilly Theatre with Angela Lansbury, which was just the most transformative experience of my life. Not necessarily in London, because, yes, we were part of the family, but I was only in it for 6 weeks because kids were restricted at that time. Yeah. But they, on the very last day of the show, July the 14th, I've never forgotten it, Piccadilly Theatre, my parents were asked into the company office to talk to the American producers. And they asked them if they would consider me going to America with the show. And they just said, "This is typical," my parents. "Oh, that's so nice. Thank you so much. What a lovely thing to be asked." And that was it. They thought it was just them being nice. A month later, when they phoned up and said, "Have you considered this question that we put to you?" And they said, "No, because we thought you didn't mean it." It was like, "Oh, you mean you were being true? You know, you were actually, you know, honest. You were actually asking this question. It wasn't just a compliment." So then they went through down this sort of trail of consideration, how they would feel, how whether my mother would be able to come with me for a year. I mean, it was a long time. Wow. My sisters were about sort of, well, what were they, 19 and 17, and were quite pleased, I think, for my mother to go away for a year. and they took on this consideration, and then the authorities said no. And my father was so incensed that he had made this big decision, this sort of family sacrifice as such, and how dare anybody say, basically imply that my parents were not caring and irresponsible. So they went to the barrister and basically, cut a very long story short, I was granted permission as a ward of court to go to America for a year. And this sort of shy little kid who'd been told to sit in a corner and be quiet suddenly was faced with seven other American kids who were very gregarious and great fun. And it brought me out of my shell completely. Mm. So when I returned to England to go back to my school, I was really taken aback by the fact that I found out later that my school friends were told not to talk to me about America because I would be big-headed.
What?
And what was so difficult about that was that I went to a school where there were quite a few kids who were who were basically children of famous people. Ken Russell's daughter was in my class, and Beryl Bainbridge's daughter was in all people like that, who had travelled. And when we were studying America, and I put my hand up to say I had been to America as well as many other people with me, I was ignored. And I found that really sad. I didn't understand why I was being excluded, and did not want to go back to that school on the following term. And in fact, my parents understood that and changed schools for me. And I remember that very first day when I went to Italia Conti, and somebody came up to me and said hello, and were very sweet. And I had a job, which was at that point Just William I was about to do, and they celebrated it in the class. They went, you know, just want to announce that Bonnie's going to be in this TV series, and, you know, we'll accommodate for it as much as possible. And it was just so joyous. I felt so comfortable, and as you say again, that word safe and seen and heard.
Yeah, because you said the word ignored there, and like that comes up on the podcast quite a lot, this idea of you putting yourself out there and doing your thing and people ignoring you. Although I will say your example is a lot more extreme than what we're talking about on the podcast. That's so unfair.
Yeah, because, but they're the same sort of thing. It's just on a bigger scale. It's more people. But it's that same emotion. It's that same feeling of thinking, what have I done wrong?
Yeah, but it's unfair for a child. I think that's really unfair, because the people there at school are applying sort of adult logic and emotion and feeling to children there. But actually, children just need to be encouraged. Children need to be made to feel like they can explore and be creative, and I think that's a very unfair way to treat a child, I think.
Well, I think where I was so lucky, and I feel so blessed about it all, is that, for example, when I was in Gypsy, that it was directed by Arthur Lawrence, who wrote the play as well, and from the very outset he insisted that we were called the small adults, and we were included in the company and expected to behave respectfully and not excused or excluded from the adult company. So first of all, we felt very part of it. And secondly, I think most young people will rise to that challenge. Yes, okay, young people have not had the same years of experience as others, but we're, you know, we were sponges. And most children will, if they are treated with respect and dignity, will rise to that that requirement, really, and enjoy it and embrace it. I always found that if anybody patronised me or talked down to me as, you know, oh, you're just a little, how are you today? Or even talked to my mother as if I had no hearing or sight or anything. Yeah, how is she? How's she doing? And I would say, she's fine, thank you. And she's standing right here. And I think we're all a bit like that. We like to be just treated on a level. And from that moment, it gave me, you know, I still to this day will find that, you know, it's so important. Yeah. And one of the things I know that Angela used to do, Angela Lansbury, she was the most phenomenal teacher, because she taught by example constantly, was very inclusive, very kind, unbelievably kind, did all the right things that a leading lady should do, but also was a little bit separate, because apart from anything else, playing Mama Rose in Gypsy is the most enormous part. And she was protected, and there were times when you kept away from her, and you knew that. She didn't have to say it. She didn't have to get cross. She didn't have to do anything. Yes, she was very protected. But also, she was magnificent in her leadership of that company. And I watched that for an entire year. What I didn't really realise as a young person was that not only was she playing this huge part, but that she also, she was, you know, her son and her daughter were struggling with drug addiction. And her son at that point came and travelled with us a lot, because he'd just come out of rehab, and she was protecting him and supporting him and hoping that she could, you know, cosset him a bit. I mean, can you imagine going through that and playing this huge role every single night? Relentlessly, without taking a single night off. I mean, we all absolutely adored her, and I do to this absolute day, because what she would do was she would pay attention to the small things. Every single party we ever had, she would come, to say, have a wonderful time, I've brought you a crate of champagne. Then leave. She arranged for the kids to go on a private tour of Disneyland, mainly because we needed to get through the queues and get back to the show at night. But she arranged for that to happen. She would give generously, but also she would keep herself one step away. And every single time you gave her a gift, handwritten note. And her family have kept that up, because even to this day, I was in touch with her until the very end. And then on her passing, I sent an email to the family. I got a note back, a printed note, to say thank you so much for your gratitude and your kindness. And so that completed my whole journey being with, associated with somebody like that. And she, as a young person, that taught me so much about how important it is. And that although we're in a job where we have that opportunity to meet people who think they know us, who really don't. I mean, I meet so many people who come up and talk to me. I've got no idea who they are. Yeah. But what's important is that, they'll come up. The other day, I took my mum to the doctor's yesterday. I sat there and I thought, gosh, that's amazing that I'm sitting in this waiting room where 40 years ago, apparently, I gave up my chair for a young boy who was poorly. Now, I don't know why I did that, really. But this woman sent me a tweet the other day saying, thank you so much. 40 years ago, you gave up your seat for my child when he was poorly. And he's now 53 or something. You know? I mean, it was just... But you see, the trouble is you're very visible. And if you don't do that, then you get told, oh, they're really up themselves. So, there's that kind of combination. Yeah, our body wouldn't move from here. Yeah, where you could... If you're not on the telly, you could be a completely anonymous person and they would never remember. So there's sort of good and bad with that. But I do think it's just very important, and I think... As a young person on the receiving end of that, of being elevated to that place, not only where you're visible, but also where you're in an environment that's very adult when you're young.
Yeah.
That you were, the expectations were high, but also you understand the receiving end of it as well as the giving end. And I think that taught me a big lesson when I was very young.
Definitely.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah. Sorry, Charles.
We're becoming symbiote again. No, I was going to say there's so much to sort of unpack there a little bit. And I was thinking, we talk a lot on the podcast about mentors. And I guess Angela was a mentor of sorts, obviously not maybe as hands-on, but just seeing how she went about her craft and how she went about as a person as well is obviously very impactful for you. And something that you've obviously kept going yourself and probably you've taken into other workplaces.
Hopefully. I mean, that's the lucky thing about starting as a child, is that you're not expected to engage in conversation too much. And that's, as I say, if you're included and you're invited into a conversation and you rise to that challenge. But a lot of the time, I didn't have to do the small talk. Yeah. I didn't have to go to the parties and do all the networking and all that stuff because I wasn't expected to by. The flip side to that is that, you might get a little bit ignored, but you can watch and learn
so much.
Yeah. It's fascinating. Fascinating.
Yeah. And I think that idea of... I always get really excited when I find out celebrities are nice. Or footballers or whoever. And I don't know if that says more about me than it does about
that
them.
Terrible.
But you know what I mean? Like, I love it. If it turns out, that celebrity's nice, I'm like, I like that as well. But so I guess... You're saying about that sort of pressure, maybe, that if you're in the public eye, that an added layer, maybe, of pressure to be nice and make sure that no one says, so-and-so was... But if you've been brought up like that and if you've been around that environment and you clearly had very sort of grounded home life as well, then actually that's just kind of in you anyway. So then if you end up being famous, you just take that life experience out into the world. And I think that's very nice. And I was wondering if, as well, you're talking about sort of working with Angela and those early jobs, if maybe luck comes into it sometimes, because you could have been in a cast that was completely different and people had their struggles and whatever, but you were very lucky to be placed with people that then passed on these life experiences to you, and I guess you were ready as a young person to take them on.
You're absolutely right. As I say, I feel very blessed that I was in that environment at that age, and that I was able to sort of absorb all those lovely things. Yes, there are companies that are not like that at all. And sometimes I think now, in their efforts to protect children, that we sometimes exclude them from the opportunity to rise to different situations, and that we go, oh, no, they're the children, they'd have to go somewhere else. Well, actually, if you allow them to embrace and to be exposed to some adult areas and worlds, then you actually find that they, you know, as long as you are aware and you're cautious, you know, I'm not saying that anyone needs to expose a child to anything awful, but, you know, young people are so much more resilient. And I think, you know, going on to sort of the recent things, you know, with the pandemic and all that stuff, I think we have, you know, I think it's very difficult for young people of all different ages this at the moment, because there is an element where we are not teaching them coping mechanisms. We are teaching them how to almost indulge and search for problems. Well, yes, life has problems and we have to learn how to overcome them. And I'm not saying you have to throw anybody in at the deep end. And I feel very lucky that I did have a safe space. But also I was from an old-fashioned family in many respects where, you know, we were told to keep calm and carry on. And there were times when that was seemingly quite harsh. But actually, I think in many respects, it gives you that outer coating that we all need. We all need a little bit of armour. And I think if we were to look at sort of animals, the animal that we need to be is the tortoise, so that we've got a hard shell and a soft centre. But sometimes protecting that soft centre can be very tricky.
Yeah.
But the sooner we you know, it's like when kids fall over. You know, yes, okay, there might be a time when they've broken their leg. Yes, you need to take them to hospital. But there are other times when you need to say, come on, that's it, great. Oh, dear, look at that. We acknowledge what's wrong. We don't ignore it, which was a bit old school. Was, you know, no, there's nothing wrong with you. Well, actually, there is, because my leg is bleeding. No, you need to go, oh, dear, we need to patch that up, and then you carry on. Learn how to get up and carry on.
I've written down be a tortoise, because, like, we have merchandise. That's a T-shirt, I think, for me.
Yeah, you see? That. Be a tortoise. The only trouble with that is that if a tortoise tips upside down, it flails a little bit with its legs. Right, sometimes it needs somebody to tip it up the right way.
Honestly, that works as an analogy. We all end up upside down sometimes, and we all need someone to tip us up the other way. So I think it works. But you're right about sort of giving young people the chance to, because we've got a 3-year-old and a 10-week-old, so we're very much in that kind of
space.
Yeah,
that's a lot.
That explains the bags under my eyes, if anyone's wondering. But we try really hard with our daughter that if she's fallen over, it's acknowledging, I understand you're feeling upset right now. That's, you know, you've hurt yourself, you're upset. That's okay. I understand that. But let me give you a big cuddle. Let's see. You're okay. Let's crack on. So it's like acknowledge, accept. Don't like say, you know, oh, you're fine. As you said, acknowledge the feeling, but also then give them the support and like the encouragement that they can sort of. And I guess it comes back to this, the safety and the love. Like, you are loved. You are safe. It's okay. Yeah, I understand your feelings, and it's okay to have those feelings. But we're going to be okay, you know, together, kind of thing. It's a balance, a tricky balance, being a parent. It is a lot of things.
Also, isn't there that thing, I can't remember it now, where there's a hole in the road and you walk along and you fall in the hole, and there's all that thing about, does somebody get down into the hole with you? No, because then you're stuffed. Neither of you can get out.
Yeah.
What do? You throw them a rope, you get them out, and then you don't. Then you learn, don't walk down that road, because there's a hole in it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's that kind of thing. Do we keep repeating the same mistakes until we finally go, I'm not going to go down there again? And that's something we spend our entire lives doing. I mean, you'd think it would be something we could learn as kids, but no. And in fact, my daughter said to me the other day, you know, I can do this, I'm an adult. I said, do not feel that being an adult means you know anything. I said, all we do is we're like swans. We're trying to look like we're so graceful on top, but underneath the legs are going like hell. And they'll keep going like hell, and we're all paddling to stay afloat. So honestly, do not think that I'm an adult, I know everything. No way. We're still learning as much as we were as little toddlers, quite frankly.
Agreed. And that's another good animal analogy. Keep up the animal analogies on the pod, I think we'll be onto something.
You can tell that I go out a lot with my dog because obviously that's all I do is look at the swans and the ducks and the geese.
And the tortoises.
And the tortoises.
This is something that's come up on the pod as well, is that it was what you were saying about obviously your previous school and how it was kind of not discouraged, but you weren't allowed to obviously express how you were feeling about these exciting things you were doing. And I guess at Italia Conti, it was more, that was more embraced and you know, that was you were celebrated a lot more. And that's something that's come up before on the pod, is that that kind of feeling that at some stage calls that it's, you know, you need to learn the craft. And then go and do the thing, rather than doing the thing while you're learning the craft, if that makes sense. Did you find that it was, at Italia Conti, that there was a good balance of being able to work and learn?
Yeah, I think the best way to learn is through experience. And what I wonder about as well with young people these days is that, first of all, they're encouraged to do exam. They come out maybe, especially from the drama schools or the theatre schools, which didn't exist when I was younger. I mean, there were drama schools, of course, but there weren't musical theatre schools, which seemed to be popping up everywhere. Yeah. And that's not a bad thing. But the only thing I would find is that you know, sometimes people think, oh, I've got a degree. That's it then. I'm sorted. Mm. This is when it begins. It's like when you pass your driving test, that's when you actually start to drive. I'm so glad they invented P plates, because at least you know, and I remember when I learned to drive and suddenly they took the L plates off and I was like, oh no, I'm on my own in a car, I don't know what I'm doing and all this stuff, you know. And people are horrible then, you know, and you learn very quickly. But I do wonder that, you know, so much is put on, you know, you get this degree, you get this exam, you pass this, you know, there's such, you know, I think it's important to give kids the responsibility and the understanding that we have tests in life, but they're not always on a piece of paper in a quiet room for 2 hours. And some people have different strengths. Some people, you know, they look at, you know, for example, I look at a tax form in accountancy and I think, oh, I don't know how to do this. My eyes, you know, I get the kind of the Tom and Jerry roller blinds going up and down my eyes thinking, oh, I'm going to switch off. It doesn't mean I can't do it. I probably could, but you know, it's not my strength. It's not something that is interesting. I think some people are hugely practical. Rishi, what's it, turned around and said, oh, it's all going to be numbers. Oh no, please. Yeah. You know, yes, we understand that maths comes into everything, but there are ways that some people, you know, absorb information better than others, and different ways. But as I say, you know, so much pressure is put on exam. And then ultimately, no. In fact, it's another thing my daughter said to me, that one of her friends, she was wanting to go into a musical theatre, a sixth form. And one of her friends said, well, you can't do musical theatre unless you've got your GCSEs. And my daughter had taken that a little bit too literally and went, but I don't think my mum's ever given her GCSE exam results to when she does an auditions for anything. And it's true, you know, it's as you go, never in a million years. But I think they were meaning the course. You can't get into this course without it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's how do we teach young people to be accomplished, to have a certain standard so that there's a base level where people can, you know, can say, okay, yes, we understand that, you know, you can read and write and you've got the basic skills of life, but you have other strengths, and that somebody who might have the most amazing exam results can't actually speak to a person. Because they're so they're socially, you know, not that way inclined or whatever, or they can't express themselves. And yet there's someone who's much more practical about problem solving than the person who probably has the better exam results. So although I'm sure it's very difficult and I wouldn't want to be in charge of any kind of education or system that way, what I find is that quite often when I work with people who are new graduates, it's really disarming for them because they don't understand that you're on your own, kid. And the way you react to people, the way you are socially, the way you are, and I don't mean as in going to parties, I mean in a room, in a rehearsal room, how you take notes and criticism. And at one point, my daughter was going to go to a college, and they said, okay, well, we don't allow any public performances until their very final one, and nobody is allowed to see them other than people within the college. And I went, but they're not getting any practical experience.
Yeah.
Mm.
You know, and all that thing that I got, as I say, working with people like Arthur Lawrence, Angela Lansbury, Stevenson, those lessons have been the greatest lessons of my life. So if you were in an environment where it's only people you know telling you whether you're good, bad or indifferent, that's no good. They're not seeing you for that. They're seeing you because they know all your history that goes on, as we said, like the swan under the water. Yeah. And you're going to be judged, accepted, you know, in a world where people see you at, you know, at that, you know, and quite often they'll go, oh, well, they'll take you because you're a nice person. No, they won't. They'll take you in a job because you fit the costume. Yeah. Sorry, that's generally, I mean, no, you have to be able to do the job, but sometimes that's the case. Mm. You might not be the most talented person in the room, but if you are the one that turns up 8 shows a week and gets on with it, and you don't make any fuss, and you are obliging, kind, all those sorts of things, fabulous.
Yeah.
That will be... you will probably get the job over that person or whatever. I mean, it might just be something absolutely basic that you happen to be there at the time. And often I don't think that, particularly in this industry, and particularly at the moment, you know, I mean, it used to be terribly tough, you know, really tough out there. And I'm not saying that's right. But sometimes I think it means you know where you stand a bit more.
Mm.
And there is a little bit too much cotton wool going on these days. Or I think it can be harsh in another way, that we're leading kids to think that they're going to be looked after. And that's a bonus. That's not a given. And that every job you do is you're proving yourself again.
Yeah.
And, you know, and as we were saying about as you get older, it gets harder because, yeah, you think, oh, my goodness, this might be my last job. I'm going to be found out.
Oh, yeah.
And it's they're going to find me out. Yeah, I'm not going to get another job. And, yeah, no matter who you are, no matter how you are, you can do the best job in the world and you never get employed for months. And you think, well, why? I thought I did all right. And you've got to learn how to get through that. It drives me mad when people, particularly not in the business, who say, oh, you're resting. Are you resting?
Yeah.
No, that's the last thing you do. You have to spend your whole life being, you know, proactive.
Yeah.
Hustling.
Yeah, hustling.
Hustling.
Yeah. Well, that analogy of the swan is actually really good for entertainment industry, because you are constantly, even if you're someone who's been on TV for years, you're constantly still swimming away underneath, trying to you know, get meetings, trying to get yourself, I don't know, whatever, like it's all like that. And actually the stuff people see, the stuff on TV or these days maybe internet, whatever, like that is the very, it's tip of the iceberg really, and the rest of it is so, it is a real, I quite often say to my friends, like, it's a slog. And that's the wrong word, because that makes it sound like I'm not enjoying it, because I do enjoy it. But it is.
Yeah, but you don't enjoy it all the time. I'm sure you don't enjoy it all the time. There are times when you think, I just don't feel like it today.
Yeah, oh,
I just
totally
don't feel like it.
There are times I think, why have I not got a full-time job? Why do I not get a boring full-time job? Because I know I'd quit it within a week. So what's the point?
Yeah,
I've said this to my wife. I've said, oh, maybe I should just get a normal job.
Yeah.
And she said, you'll be so miserable.
You'll be so miserable. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And all you'll be thinking about is, why did I take this job?
Well, I say like my daughter again. My daughter just took a seasonal job thinking, oh, that would work okay. She said, never again. I can't deal with it. It's just, it's a different sense of humour apart from anything else.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when you're in this business, there's just a different kind of language that we all speak. And maybe that's the same with every job, but we don't do that, you know, because we're not accountants or whatever. We don't have that same sort of way, but there is something about the empathy of being in the same boat.
Yeah, well, that, actually, that made me think earlier you said about, you know, when you went to Italia Conti and people were sort of celebrating what you'd done. And it made me think about sort of being in these same spaces as people that share the love for what we do. Like, it's, and I guess it's the same as when you go and work in a company, and people on the pod have talked before about, like, you form this little family for a bit and then you go off and do your next job and maybe you keep in contact, maybe you don't. But that feeling, and I guess it's hard to explain, but that feeling of when you're in a room and you're with people who love the same thing you love and do the same thing you do, and it's like sort of like bus drivers doing the nod as they drive past, like, you get it, I get it, I'm with my people, I'm safe. And that's an amazing feeling, whether you're, like, you know, in a band like Giles, or you're on stage or on TV, or even just a creative room, maybe you're in a writer's room or something. Like, that feeling is lovely when you're with people that just get it.
Yes. And doesn't it make you breathe out?
Yeah, completely.
You just go, oh, here I am. Yeah. That's okay. And you do, you know, the one thing is that you make friends very quickly.
Yeah.
And they may be fair weather friends, or they may be friends for life. Yeah. You don't really know. And then you're on to the next job, and you need to bond very quickly. I think we're very good at bonding in this job and very good at connecting with people. And sometimes that's a bad thing, because you find that you then, first of all, you have to finish very quickly, or you might be friends with someone suddenly sort of in the street and then you don't want to be, or you know what I mean? There is that, sometimes you're a bit too open, you know, and you do open yourself out to things, and then you think, oh, I haven't heard from them ever again.
Yeah.
And that's sad. And it's sometimes very difficult. You know, I'm one of those people that I'm immediately very friendly with everyone, probably too much. And then I might feel a little bit abandoned or walked over, and in my efforts to protect myself, I can sometimes be a bit, you know, we have these different levels of friendship, don't we? It's sort of like coming into the bullseye in the middle, where, you know, you have your friends you sort of see in Sainsbury's or whatever, and then you have more and more closer friends as you come near. And there was particularly one time when I was sort of in my teens, early 20s, where I had so many friends so many colleagues, and not really any friends.
Yeah.
And that's a lot to do with the fact that I have probably been burnt by friends, because you do, because that's what happens. It's not really personal, and or let down. And so you don't let people into that inner sanctum, do you? You don't really let people close. Mm. And sometimes I'm too good at being on my own and keeping that drawbridge up. And then when you do turn around and say, I need help, people don't expect, so they don't hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. You know, or you might have those people that come in and help you so much, and then they're suddenly telling everybody down the street that you're having this problem. So I think it's the trust thing. Yeah. Trust can be a big difficulty, because, you know, that there's people that you want to trust, and that it's difficult to work out in life who you really can trust. I'm actually quite sort of maybe envious in some respects of people who have childhood friends, who have had friends that are, you know, like sisters, and, you know, that have that bond with groups of people, or, you know, one or two people. Because I suppose we mix with so many different people throughout our lives, and so many different types of people from many different walks of life, that it can be difficult to find those people that you really do trust and that stay there. So I suppose I haven't had that. I have friends who are who I've known for many years, but sometimes there are very few people, and I suppose quality better than quantity, that you can actually go, you're my kind of second family as such, and if I really did need help at 3 o'clock in the morning, I could call you and I know you'd be there for me. So there's, you know, it's tricky, isn't it? There's only a few that you can have where you literally do reveal that kind of. And I think a lot of that was because all throughout my life, I was always meant to be bubbly Bonnie Langford. I was meant to be this happy-go-lucky, happy person. And there were times, and there are times when we all have, when we don't feel that way.
Yeah.
We don't feel like it.
Yeah.
But then if you say that to somebody, particularly if you say that to somebody in the press, and you go, well, no, I'm actually not really happy. Oh, you're having a breakdown. No, I'm really, oh, you hated your childhood. Oh, you wanted to become this. Oh, you had this terrible time. No, I had the most fantastic time. Some of those transitions were tricky.
Yeah.
Some of those transitions have been tricky. Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, there's two sides to that, because we try not to show that side of us because we're expected to be the person that cheers everybody up.
Yeah.
Or that we, you know, we carry on and we, you know, that resilience thing. And we don't want to say we're falling into some kind of abyss, but you do spiral down.
Yeah.
And then you can spiral up again.
Yeah.
And sometimes you need somebody to go, do you know what? I'm not cartwheeling down the street because I don't.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean to say I'm booking myself into the Priory tomorrow, because I'm just, you know, a wobble. We're having a wobble.
It's the old Pagliucci, isn't it? Pagliucci the clown, you know, the
absolutely.
But Dr. I am Pagliucci. I'm sure everyone knows that parable, kind of parable, but yeah, you're right. I guess like if people build up an image of you, and it goes back to what you're saying earlier about, you know, a lot of people do that and they don't know you, they feel like they do, they love you, they feel like they do, but they don't really know you, and then they build up an image and then you suddenly don't meet that image through absolutely no fault of your own. You're only human. We are a ball of wires and emotions, and it is complicated in there, and it goes up and it goes down, and that is completely normal. But it's not your fault that you're not matching up to their expectation, and then suddenly they're the ones feeling weird about you, and you're like, hang on, I'm just being human.
Yeah, I'm allowed to be having a bad day. And that can be difficult, and you know, and yet there is also, there's almost this guilt when you say I can't do this today. And I found that very difficult to turn around and not do the perfectionism thing, you know, not to do the, but I have to be perfect. I found that when I was doing Dancing on Ice, that was quite a great time in many respects. I was in the very, very first series ever of Dancing on Ice. And in some respects, it was really freeing, liberating to be able to say, I can't do that. Because, you know, I'd never ice skated in my life. I didn't ever want to. And I suppose I hadn't, until that time, I'd never really been allowed to say, I don't know how to do that. Because one of the other things starting young is that it was always a case of, don't be excused for your age. Always be professional. Don't be, oh, well, she's only a kid, so how'd she be able to do that? I was always expected to be very professional and, you know, be impressed people with your kind of ability to do things. And in fact, when it then came to sort of ice skating, I was able to say, I can't do this. And that it kind of took it back to that basic again, of learning. It was right, relearning with a clean slate as such. And then you want to lean, then you need your device. I mean, I've never been so nervous in my entire life. And yet when the first day came, you know, that first show ever, what was great was that the director who I knew came up to me and said, I don't know if you want to know, but I just, so you know, where I'm on cameras for you. I'm on this one, on that bit, and that bit, and that bit. If you want to, you can look at the camera. And I went back into that lovely place where I was when I was six, where they said, if you look down that big camera over there, you'll be looking at your friends at home. And it allowed me to divert my attention to something I knew how to do. It became technical, and it helped me calm my nerves. Because I wasn't thinking, I can't do this, I can't do this, oh my gosh, why am I here? I can't do this. It was like, okay, oh, here's something I can do. And it can distract me from the other thing that made me feel completely and utterly at sea.
But then, you're so right about that clean slate of like, I can't do this thing, but I want to try. And, you know, maybe I can at some point. I've started, my personal trainer brought in these, like, gymnastic rings things, and they have in the Olympics, the sort of rings.
Oh, my gosh.
And he was saying, like, oh, I've just been, like, mucking around on them. He's obviously, like, really toned, and I'm not. But he's, like, and he was, like, showing me flips and stuff. And I was like, oh, mate, that is so cool, but there's no way I can do that. And he was like, yeah, you can. And so we just worked on it, and that was about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and now I can do
it. You still can't do it.
I still can't do it. I'm actually worse than I was before. No, I can now do a flip. I can do a flip. I can hold myself. I can, like, yeah, and I feel like, yeah, like a kid again. I feel so, like, proud of myself that I can do this thing that looks great, and I guess it's the same sort of thing. But you did pretty well in Dancing on Ice, didn't you?
I did, but it was ignorance that was bliss. I mean, I think if I'd known anything more, I'd never done it. I was the reserve. I only had 2 weeks training, so I didn't have any real sort of expectations either. And then it became, it was the same, you know, we then did the telly show, things were expected of us. I did tours, then I went back and did it again. And that's when you start to sort of do the, oh my goodness, I'm supposed to be better than this.
Right.
I mean, it's quite levelling when you see someone like Jane Torvill and Christopher Dean fall over, which I did see them do, and it was like, well, if they fall over, exactly. There's absolutely no blooming hope for me. And there is, it is difficult to go, it's okay to fail.
Yeah.
I find the word fail very difficult to deal with, because it's always do your best. And then you're basically saying, well, I did my best and I failed, so I'm not good enough. And you have to kind of deal with that kind of thing. You know, no, I was, because I gave it a go. And I'll get up and try again, yeah. Or I'll with dignity walk away. It's just, when do you walk away? But yeah, I did. I also learned at one point, I had some lessons on the silks. You know, those things that, you know, where they just have basically two bits of material that hang down. I thought, I'd love to have a go at that.
Yeah.
Good grief, it's difficult. Oh my Lord. But I just did it for fun.
Yeah.
And I suppose we have to do those things where we just have fun. That's why I've got a little doggy, is because we run out in the park. And you know what? To see her just enjoying running and chasing a squirrel, you cannot help but smile. And you've got to try and keep that in your life, a little bit of childish fun. I mean, having kids makes you become a kid again. It gives you an excuse to
definitely.
Be a dad. But there's that huge weight of responsibility at the same time. But you've got to try and keep in touch with that inner child, haven't you?
Yeah, chase the squirrel. There you go. It's another good analogy.
See, we're
just
wrapping
them up. The animal analogy.
I don't know why we're down the animal route, but anyway, I keep going down there.
Bonnie, tell us about EastEnders, because obviously that was must have been a massive thing for you to obviously be in this, such an iconic show. Tell us about how it came about and your time there.
Well, it came about completely out of the blue. I mean, never on my bucket list. I mean, often people will say to you, oh, you know, what do you want to do next? What's your bucket list? And I go, well, I don't have one, because actually what life has thrown at me has been far more interesting than I would have ever designed. And I do believe that things are thrown at you at certain times in your life. Sometimes that's hard to hold
Absolutely,
on to, but you do think, look, we have to have faith, we have to have hope that whatever is coming is for the right reason. And if I'm challenged, then it's because I've got to be pushed out of this little comfort zone I've got myself into. So I was doing a show in London. I was doing a show called Dirty Rotten Scoundrels in London. And
based on the movie, the Michael Caine movie.
Yeah, that's right, yes. And so I'd gone into that just quickly. I took over from Samantha Bond and I ended up staying there for sort of about 6 months. The show was closing. Just before it was closing, I got this call to say, would I go in to read for a part? And I didn't even get the sides until 10 minutes before I walked in. You know, it was one of those, we'll hand you a scene on the day. Well, in some respects, it's great, because then you're not expected to learn it, are you?
Yeah.
You just go, well, I've only just got this, so I'm sight reading. Anyway, so I thought it was amazing. And I was signed for 8 episodes, that was all. And I went in and played this. I was completely in awe of the people there, because it's an utter machine. It's incredible. I mean, talk about expectations of turn it on, you know, with a click, you know, okay. I mean, and towards the end, it was hilarious. I was doing scenes. There was one day I had to do, I think it was 15 scenes in a day. And we were doing sort of pickups of various other things that had happened before and what have you. And re-shooting things, because a lot of it is all editorial policy. You have to be cleared by certain things and you have to do things a certain way. And I did find myself at one point, the director came up to me on that day and said, okay, so we've got to take lunch in 20 minutes. We can do it now and come back and do the rest of them, or we could just try this one scene. So do you fancy doing the attempted suicide scene now before lunch? Yeah, let's just do it now before lunch.
Whoa.
You know, and you find yourself, you think, what am I saying?
Yeah.
It should be, you know, and we did it in 20 minutes and we did it and that was it. Great. So we could go to lunch and we're done. But, you know, you think the reality as to what you're, you know, going, you know, the content as opposed to the practicality of this scene has to be done. What is it? Oh, I don't know. Let's just get the scene done.
Yeah.
And I like that, actually. I like the speed of it and I got very used to it. But I was in total awe of how it works so quickly, how the actors are so brilliant at just working out where the different cameras are, because you film it multi-camera. And, you know, and one thing that one of the actors said to me when I got there was, you know, first of all, look after your character. You're the only constant.
Yeah.
Because in and out come executive producers, directors, yeah, are different every block, and they don't know what your character's done 6 months before, but you do. You know, you try and also choose your battles, because you might be doing something that might seemingly be out of character, but if really all you're there for is to furnish somebody else's story, then you might have to kind of go, oh, I've got to let this one go. Yeah. Yeah, my character wouldn't necessarily do this, but it's a device to get through to something else, and you don't know what that story is coming. You don't know whose story that you're part of. Anyway, so I went in, I did these 8 episodes, had a great time, that was that. And then, fortunately, they called me and said, would you come back and do a year? And then I ended up staying 3.5 years. But it was perfect, because it happened at a time when I needed to be at home. I was a single parent by then. My daughter was at college, and it meant that I could be at home. And I was keeping a roof over our head. And it was very intense at times. And then at other times, you're not doing anything. So it's hilarious, because you either spend your whole time thinking, oh, my goodness, I've got so much to do and so much to learn and I can't deal with this. And then the minute you're not in any scripts, you think, they're going to get rid of me. That's it. I'm over. You live in a constant state of paranoia, because you have no idea whether, you know, and quite often there is that terrible moment. I mean, I saw it a couple of times when, for example, like makeup or costume might go up to somebody and say, oh, I'm so glad I'm doing your last block. And you go, what?
Oh, no.
You mean I'm not in it anymore? No. Oh, did you not know? I mean, it's terrible.
Oh, God, that's horrendous.
I really think they should do a sort of a W1A of soaps.
Yeah.
Because it is bizarre how you behave in the end.
Oh, you've got to pitch that. It's a great idea.
It's just a madness, isn't it? You know, I mean, they did it with soap years ago in America. There was this fantastic comedy series that launched Billy Crystal and artists like that.
Oh,
but I think there is a sort of, a W1A type series that could happen that is about soap operas. But then most of the time, I think people watching it would say, that's ridiculous, that doesn't happen. But it does.
And is that like the sort of fast turnaround and stuff, and like having to like sort of like learn on your feet and stuff? And is that why soaps are quite a good breeding ground for actors going on to other stuff? Like, you know, so, Neighbours has produced so many movie stars and stuff. Is it you're just learning so many skills in the job?
So many skills. You learn so many skills because you are really working as a team, although you might have different crew, although a lot of them, they're there, you know, they keep coming back, you know them all, you become a little family. But then the weird thing about soaps, if you're not in somebody else's storyline, you might never see them.
Yeah.
I mean, there were certain actors who were in that who I really didn't know at all because you just don't ever cross paths with them. But what you learn as well is you learn how to help the scene by being in a certain position where you're helping with that over the shoulder shot. You might, you know, they're rigging the lights very quickly, and if you took a half a step to your left, you would be in your light and or giving your fellow artist a better eye line. You learn these things so quickly, or you don't, because you don't stay. But you know, I remember one time when I was first in the show, I had a scene round a dinner table. So you learn very quickly when to eat, because you have to remember when you've put a mouthful in, and generally it's not good to put an entire mouthful of something and then you've got a line, because you're like or chewing.
And
then there was one time where continuity, you don't have that, so you have to try and think, okay, how am I going to work this one? Okay, work it through. When did I put my glass down or whatever?
Yeah.
And then there was one time when I had a glass in my hand and I was holding it up, like you sometimes do, holding it. I didn't realise until we cut that, and the cameraman over my right shoulder said, could you put the glass down, because you're actually covering this person's shot the whole way through. Oh, my God, I hadn't realised. Yeah. You were over my shoulder, and obviously my lovely great big glass was bang, smack bang in the front of that shot. This poor person was doing all this wonderful acting, and I was completely covering it with my glass. Put the glass down. You know, it's those sorts of things that they, you know, they shortcut so brilliantly. And all, another thing I said when I first got there was, you know, I don't know how I'm going to remember all these lines.
Yeah.
And one of the other actors said to me, you don't learn them, you remember them. So, yeah, so I had said, I don't know how I'm going to learn all this. And he'd said, you don't learn them, you remember them. And then you wipe them.
Yeah.
You don't keep them in that brain because you cannot possibly, clutter your brain up that much. You literally, you learn it the day before, and you have it there. You look at the lines quickly. I mean, on soap sets, there are so many old sides in behind cushions on sofas, in drawers, because so many of us would be looking at something literally, and they're going, right, running up, recording, and you're literally looking at it till the last second, and then you put it away somewhere, or you hide it behind a gun. What am I doing again? Oh, let me just have another little look. Okay, I've got that. Yep. And you say it while you've got it in your head that minute, and then you can think, okay, that's gone now.
So when you're watching EastEnders and someone's doing a scene, you can think, right, behind that cushion, there's a slide behind that teapot. Like, it's just hidden. It'd be great, like, spot the ball competition.
Yeah, I know. Well, hopefully not, because hopefully you don't spot
don't
them.
See them.
But yeah, you're always having to sort of or fold them up and put them in your pocket. I mean, I always found it easier to have my scripts on paper.
Yeah.
I'm one of those people that likes to be able to see it clearer rather than on an iPad. But of course, so much is on iPads and things now, yeah, which is fine. But there's a lot of housekeeping that you need to do. You have to have quite an organized mind. Mm. Because it's difficult to work out. Like I said, we were filming so much stuff out of context at one point that you work out, hang on, what day is this? Where have I just been? Where am I in the story of all this? And I learned that at a very young age when I did Doctor Who as well. You know, how many times have I seen this monster? Is this oh no, not you again? Or is this, oh my goodness, what the heck is that?
Yeah,
or is this, will you stop following me? Or is this, oh my goodness, you're going to kill me? You learn how to create your own story arc, because in theatre, obviously, I love the fact when you do theatre, I feel like it's sort of peeling an onion. Gradually you take off the layers and the layers and the layers, and you learn how to sustain, you learn how to create that freshness that, you know, the audience think it is the first time you've said that line, without it being that different, because you have to have a consistency and a continuity. But at the same time, it has to appear that it's completely fresh.
Yeah.
And I love, you know, how you find new things every day. With soap, you have to dive in very quickly. And although you might start to learn how your character has grown over a period of time, and maybe react differently, there are times when you just have to literally knock it out of the park and get on with it.
Yeah. Which is a good, you know, metaphor for life. It comes back to what you were saying earlier, isn't it? Sometimes you just got to knock it out the park. It wasn't an animal analogy, but we feel like it.
No, but it was a park analogy. So there you go.
Exactly.
You see, I'm out in the park.
Still on brand.
Seeing the squirrels and the tortoises and the swans. And now I'm talking about the park again. So I'm constantly in and out of the park.
Love it. What a lovely thread for the whole episode. Yeah. Completely spot on.
Well, Bonnie, honestly, it's been such a joy to talk to you.
We could talk to you for hours.
We could talk for hours, and
thank you.
Appreciate all your time and your thoughts on
total pleasure. It's an absolute joy because it's talking about what you've done, but kind of more why or how, and that's always such a blissful thing to do, because a lot of the time people don't, you know, they don't think about actually maybe. You have to turn it on, or you have to navigate life.
Yeah.
And although you might be on the telly, it's no different. You know, you're just a bit more viewed by people in their living rooms and in their homes, which I think is you play it differently then. And it's a privilege to be invited into their homes, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
And we were talking about EastEnders, and the number of people who still come up to me and talk about my final story was all about my son being knifed and murdered. And they actually brought normal people into these episodes, and I say normal people, but people who had experienced this firsthand had lost a loved one, particularly a boy. And it was just, you know, in some respects it was difficult because we were filming this one scene, particularly the funeral, and we had to walk through the path of the location following the coffin. And this lady was standing there in the scene, as she was supposed to do, with a picture of her son. And suddenly she just absolutely broke down. She completely broke down. And I went over to her and I said, look, if this is too much for you, please don't feel you're obliged to do this. And she said, no, she said, I haven't been able to cry until now because I was trying to be so strong for everybody else. And I had so much to do.
Yeah.
And this is my first moment that I've had a chance to really realize it. And she said, you know, I didn't cry when my son was buried, but now your son's being buried. I can feel it.
Yeah.
Well, of course, it wasn't my son. It was an actor, you know, and it's very difficult to respect that, you know. Yeah. I have such respect for people who literally would come up to me and pour their hearts out. Yeah. About their real lives, and I'm thinking, I'm just an actor, it's on the page. Mm. But I feel it deeply. Mm. And we have that kind of weird responsibility of representing normal people.
Yeah, you are. You're really affecting people. You are, you know, people might think, oh, it's just a soap or whatever, but you are affecting people's lives. They attach so much emotion and love to these shows. You are really affecting their lives.
Well, they're very powerful as well, because what they do is they open a conversation.
Yeah.
If I go to the shops or something, I will have numerous young people come up to me and say, are you Carmel? And then talk about that. Wow. Now, those people would never come up to me normally, or what have you. It makes that conversation happen. Yeah. It makes it very accessible to without... And it shows... It doesn't comment necessarily, but it shows how other people may react, and it allows particularly young people to open a conversation perhaps with their parents where their parents had not imagined how they were feeling.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I never thought you would feel that way because I only feel this way.
Yeah.
Can't you feel the same?
Yeah.
I mean, we do that, don't we? We kind of think, well, I'm feeling like this, so you must feel like this as well.
Yeah.
But no, everyone has a different viewpoint because they're in a different place in their life.
Yeah, I'm finding that with my three-year-old. She's got a very different viewpoint on everything.
You see? Yes. And she's teaching you, but you're teaching her as well.
100%.
It's that whole thing. We've come full circle to show that we have different places in our lives, but ultimately we're all trying to keep going, like the swan. And the tortoise.
There we go.
And the tortoise. Yeah. And running away like the squirrel. Hey ho. Well, it's lovely to talk to you. Thank you for inviting me.
As well. And all the stuff about childhood and getting your break young, but, you know, having the support of a fantastic family as well. So many great takeaways and just a lovely, lovely hour and a bit spent with an absolute legend.
Yeah. And a phrase we haven't used for a while, Jim, or you haven't used for a while, giving yourself the wins. There was a lot of talk about that, particularly with her background in musical theatre and theatre school. How, like, obviously one experience at her first drama school was one of, like, let's play this lot down. And then obviously then she moved to Italia Conti, where it was a lot more encouragement and enthusiasm about, you know, those moments where you do something really, really spectacular with your career. And I think that's really important to, give yourself the wins sometimes.
Yeah, completely agree. Completely agree. And that's a sort of such a running theme with our episode, with our podcast, sorry. But it's nice when people come on and kind of validate that, I guess, without even trying. And you think, oh, yeah, no, this is a perfect guest for us.
Yeah.
So it's just absolutely lovely. So thank you so much to Bonnie for coming on and bringing us all those lovely animal analogies. Be more tortoise. What was it? Chase the rabbit. And there was another one that I've forgotten already. Squirrel. Sorry. Chase the squirrel.
Yeah, chase the squirrel. There was various ones. There was one about swans, like the little feet going under the water.
That's right. Yeah. Great analogies. All true.
Yeah. I know. There's lots of takeaways today.
I loved it. Absolutely loved it. We didn't read tweets out at the top, did we? We completely forgot. But shall we just... read out our Twitter handle, or should we find some tweets?
Well, we want to hear from people about their favourite opening musical numbers.
Yeah. So let us know.
Yeah. And you can, obviously, you can contact us on all platforms other than the kids' ones, like TikTok and Snapchat. But the grown-up ones, like Instagram and Facebook and...
Twitter.
I mean, Facebook, you could argue, is for sort of geriatrics now, really, isn't it?
is that us, though, I think.
Are we in that kind of, I suppose we are. If you're scrolling down your name, the age on a website.
Yeah, we're in the
top bracket, aren't we? 45 to 60.
We are in that top bracket. Yeah, I think we are probably Facebook. We're in that.
But do you use Facebook, Jim?
No.
No, exactly. No,
I barely use it.
Yeah. So, you know.
I'm a Twitter and Instagram kind of guy.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, just probably pretty much 90% of everything I do is on those two platforms.
Yeah, me too. Anyway, our handle on all those things, Twitter, Instagram and Facebook is
at blank pod.
It is. So please get in contact. Let us know your favorite opening number from a musical. Or if you just enjoyed an episode, you know, let us know about that. Or if you want someone to come on in the future, tag them in a tweet and we'll try and make it happen.
Oh,
we can't promise
that.
Anything.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
We'll try.
Yeah, but don't harass anyone.
No, just like a simple little mention or something.
Please come on the podcast. That's
yeah,
Jim
and then we'll work our magic.
Yeah,
and then
work our magic.
They'll ignore us.
Yeah, exactly. We'll contact them and they'll just say, "Nah, it's all right, thanks."
So I've just pulled my head. I pulled the wire at my headphones. I told you I was having a shocker. Oh my word! This is the problem of late night records. This is the gold that people stay on listening to the end of the pod for.
Yeah.
The garbage and the gold. Oh, yeah. That's a band name.
Yeah. That sounds like an album title.
It's an album. Yeah.
Yeah.
Garbage and the gold. Yeah.
Garbage and the gold. Yeah. Yeah.
From Indomitable. So it's their first solo album.
Indomitable sound like a sort of quite heavy, like maybe they sound
thrash,
a bit like,
thrash metal.
I was going to say a bit, maybe like, I was thinking of the band Mastodon. They probably sound a bit like that.
Okay.
Which is,
I don't know.
Yeah. I would say quite heavy.
Okay.
Bit stoner
it is,
rocky.
Is that kind of word.
Bit
yeah.
stoner rocky, maybe even.
Okay. I'm into that. I don't mind that.
The Gold and the Garbage by Indomitable.
Garbage. Yeah. You can imagine John Peel playing that or, you know, on
his equivalent.
Rest in peace.
Yeah.
Or, you know, back in the day. Or Six Music or something on that. You know?
Yeah. That's definitely a Six Music kind of vibe going on that.
Anyway, if you're still listening, thank you. You're a legend. And thanks for... we haven't plugged the Patreon. Does it matter at this point?
We have got one.
So, we've got one.
Yeah.
And there's extra content for our patrons. Yeah. It's at patreon.com/blankpodcast. But the only people listening now will be the patrons. So I think that's probably... We should have put that at the top of the show. I'm going to go to bed.
Yeah, I would.
Yeah, I'm going to go to bed. And I'll be back stronger. That's a little nod to another podcast. Next week. With another great guest on the Blank Podcast, Charles. Looking forward to it.
Always a great guest on the Blank Podcast.
Oh, I love that. That's true. Look, have a good week, mate.
And you. And remember, Jim, don't get cancelled.
Don't get cancelled.
Media Podcast.